You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Mireya Solis. I'm director of the Center for East Asia Policy Studies here at Brookings. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you to the book launch of Taming Japan's Deflation, the debate over unconventional monetary policy. The book was just published by Cornell University Press, and we're very fortunate to have three of the co-authors today: Jean Park from Loyola Marymount University, Saori Katada from the University of Southern California, and Toshiko Kojo from Tokyo University. The book addresses a fundamental question for Japan's past economic performance and the future of its economic revival. Why has it been so difficult to exit deflation? Why did it take so long for Japan to move away from monetary orthodoxy, even though it was very clear that the existing policies were not working? What then allowed for that shift towards activism in monetary policy? And now, 5 years after that shift, how is that experiment working out in Japan? So Professors Park and Katada will lay out the core arguments of the book, and then they'll be followed by commentary from two leading experts, Steve Vogel from the University of California at Berkeley and Joseph Gannon from the Peterson Institute just across the street. And we will have an opportunity to engage with Professor Kojo when we start a conversation among the panelists and then when we bring all of you to a conversation with the panel. So without further ado, Jean, if I can ask you to please get us started. Yeah, hit the button. Yeah.
Hello, thank you. Is this mic working? I can't tell.
The red light's on.
Okay. I just don't hear it. Hello. Thank you very much to the Brookings Institution and Mireya Solis for inviting us to have this event, and also to all the staff, Jennifer Mason and others, who really handled the logistics of it. We'd also like to acknowledge and thank the Center for Global Partnership, as well as University of Southern California, for providing financial support for the event. And we'd also really like to extend our thanks to Ed Gagnon and Stephen Vogel, our discussants, who took the time to read our book and show up today as discussants. And lastly, I know there are a lot of events in Washington, D.C., so thank you all for making time for our event. So I'll just jump in and talk about the key question motivating our book. And our book, as Dr. Solis mentioned, is why it took the Bank of Japan so long to take the problem of deflation seriously and then take bolder monetary measures to overcome it. So we focus specifically on the period from 1998 until roughly the end of 2012. 1998 is when the Bank of Japan became independent. At the end of 2012, Prime Minister Abe came to power, and then in March of 2013 appointed Haruhiko Kuroda, and policy pivoted sharply. So we're largely focusing on the period prior to that pivot. And just as a reference point, Kuroda launched a large-scale quantitative easing program in Japan in 2013, which was roughly about 4 years after the U.S. had launched its first quantitative easing program. So why is this question interesting? Why would we have expected the Bank of Japan to have acted earlier? There are three reasons that we think this is somewhat puzzling. The first is most obviously economic reasons. Japan had been in deflation for a really long time. In fact, its stretch of deflation was really unprecedented in the advanced capitalist economies. Just as reference point, from 1998 to 2012, from April 1st specifically, which is when the Bank of Japan became independent, through the end of 2012, of all the months during that time period, for 70% of those months, the Japanese economy experienced deflation. Right? There were also calls from economists across the world going back as early as 1998. Paul Krugman wrote an article suggesting how Japan could get out of deflation and suggested that it was in a liquidity trap. That was soon followed by Dr. Ben Bernanke's piece called Japanese Monetary Policy, A Case of Self-Induced Paralysis. So you can see that the critiques of the Bank of Japan's policy were beginning really as early as the 1990s that accelerated over the 2000s with many economists within Japan and across the world really calling on Japan to take bolder action to overcome deflation. And then thirdly, there were political reasons that we would have expected the Bank of Japan potentially to have acted. There were calls across the political spectrum for the Bank of Japan to do more. This would happen periodically with the government at times threatening the Bank of Japan to curtail its legal independence. Then around 2009, there was an anti-deflation league formed by members of the Democratic Party of Japan that included 150 members. And the calls were really across the political spectrum. Yet, as we sort of argue, Japan really didn't take the problem seriously until the very end of 2012. So the central thesis of the book is that the Bank of Japan was slow to try bolder unconventional policy for two key interrelated reasons. The first was an entrenched set of what we call specific policy ideas that made the Bank of Japan anathema to unconventional policy. And by policy ideas, we define that as a shared set of beliefs about goals, priorities, and causal relationships. Right? So first part of our argument, again, then, is these policy ideas. The second element is that a relatively closed monetary policy-making network privileged these specific ideas and limited the influence of competing ideas, such as those calls by economists that I mentioned earlier. Now, I'll talk really briefly about some of these policy ideas, what they were. In our book, we do a historical analysis of the Bank of Japan over its long institutional history, its political and economic history, to explain how these ideas came about. But for the sake of time, I won't go into those details, and I'll just kind of outline the key ideas relevant for understanding monetary policy and the Bank of Japan's view of it. The first was a very strong premium on price stability, including asset prices. The second idea that we identify was a view that monetary policy had limits in stimulating economic growth, and if used a little too liberally, would potentially trigger runaway inflation. And the third idea is an expansive view of central bank independence that made the Bank of Japan reluctant to coordinate with the government and the Ministry of Finance on economic issues. These ideas, if we think about an unconventional policy like quantitative easing, really made the Bank of Japan reluctant to try these ideas, unconventional monetary policies. Quantitative easing blurred the distinction between fiscal and monetary policy, and it compromised the Bank of Japan's independence, at least from its view, right? Because it involved the Bank of Japan directly financing the activities of the government. QE also raised the specter of inflation without stimulating the economy, and indeed that notion and idea had been codified by something that became known as the BOJ theory, or Nichigen-ron. Which was first articulated in the early 1990s by the quite influential Bank of Japan economist Kunio Okina, who argued essentially that an expansion in the monetary base would not stimulate the real economy and would basically lead to greater volatility in prices only. We want to also sort of lay out that we don't think that these ideas are necessarily unique to the Japanese context or unique to the Bank of Japan. Indeed, some could argue that there are similarities to the Bundesbank, or perhaps similar to some of the ideas at the international organization, the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland, which has been known as having the so-called BIS view. But I think what's really different in the Japanese context is that Japan was in deflation for such a long period of time, and that these ideas were so influential in policymaking over this long period of time. So the real analytic question for us is, why did these ideas predominate? You know, central banks are supposed to be independent. Monetary policy boards are chosen. The members are chosen by the executive and approved by the legislature. And they're done over different time periods from different political parties. So there should be a diversity of ideas on a monetary policy board. So how do we explain how these ideas came to predominate? The second analytic question is to show that these ideas, in fact, influenced policy. So for those two hard questions, I pass it over to Saori Katada, my co-author.
Okay. Thank you, Gene. And thank you, everyone, for coming to this workshop. And you know, I hope you can buy the book, which is sold at the back. So my role is to talk about the empirics of what we have analyzed. As the chapter shows, that there are quantitative analyses that we use the text from the BOJ board minutes and transcript, which is the quantitative analysis we had in Chapter 6. But we had three case studies that kind of provide some basis for our claim that the policy ideas and the monetary policy network really matters a lot. So before going into that case study, I would like to kind of give us the sense of how this monetary policy network is established. So as Jean mentioned, in 1998, Bank of Japan gained de jure independence through the new Bank of Japan law, which was passed by the Diet. And this was kind of a windfall for the BOJ in the sense that BOJ wasn't demanding that. Obviously, they desired, they wanted it for a long time, but this was the windfall in the sense that there was a lot of financial problems in Japan, and this was one way for the government to kind of keep track of address that through the changes, reform in Ministry of Finance. So independence came in April of 1998, and this created the policy board to be the premier institution that decides on the monetary policy. And governor and deputy governors, two deputy governors, as well as the six non-executive board members, become the privileged position in giving the deciding on the monetary policy. So there are this one, the de jure independence was critical institutional setup for the monetary policy. But also, secondly, important element of this is that there has been a very closed monetary policy network established through this independence around the BOJ board, which includes the BOJ secretariat, which are the career BOJ officials who provide information and guidance, advice to the these board members, and this becomes the central part of the decision making, and also other entities which associate with the monetary decision making, such as the Ministry of Finance, as well as some of the financial entities and so on, became part of this this monetary network. We discussed some of the career paths of the BOJ officials, how they are trained to be ingrained in this BOJ theory that Jean talked about, appointment process, which privileged this kind of a core core group of the monetary policy network, and the kind of inner circles, how these inner circles has been established through some of the network characteristics, like who gets invited to BOJ conferences and whose view dominate and so on and so forth. So this is the kind of underpinning of how this closed monetary policy network is established. We looked at three cases as to how this monetary policy decision has been influenced by the way that that ideas as well as this network provides. And one was basically on the installation and lifting of the zero interest rate policy from February 1999 to August 2000. And second was the first QE that Japan BOJ implemented from March 2001, lifted in March 2006. But what I would like to talk about here is the post-global financial crisis implementation of BOJ monetary policy. So this is the 10th year anniversary of the global financial crisis, and the crisis might be fresh in your memory still. But and also, you know, we are to some extent living in the aftermath of this global financial crisis with unwinding of the QE and things like that. But BOJ's policy in relation to global financial crisis was quite peculiar. There are three evidences that I would like to provide where BOJ was not totally on board with the aggressive QEs that other advanced nations implemented in the aftermath. First of all, BOJ didn't even participate in joint interest rate reduction, which took place in October 6th and 7th in 2008. Secondly, they were very reluctant. The policy board didn't vote in reducing the core rate, which at that point was obviously very low, 0.5%, but still they could have reduced quite a bit, and there was opposition from Governor Shirakawa to reduce it aggressively. And also there were some installation of quite a bit of emergency fund mechanisms, but they were minor part of it. And they had time limits as well as magnitude limits. That was not conveying the kind of commitment on the part of BOJ to really stimulate the economy. So as the consequence, there has been a significant an appreciation coming from other countries being aggressively taking the QE and aggressive monetary stance. Japanese economy recovered much more slowly, even though it was one of the countries whose financial sector was not impacted by the crisis itself, which I will get to in a minute. And also there has been, you know, because of that major contraction of GDP of Japanese economy 2009 into farther. So this was the kind of probably considered as one of the major a major kind of detrimental effect that monetary policy had on Japan. So why did the BOJ implement this type of reluctant policy when it comes to that facing the crisis? There are three reasons that we investigated, looked into through the minutes and interviews that we conducted. First of all, there was a notion that because Japanese financial sector, which was considered to be one of the major entity that BOJ is trying to protect and secure, was not affected, that Japanese economy would be fine. So they were somewhat of optimism on the part of the BOJ not to tackle this as seriously as it probably should have. The second was that there has been a pretty clear indication of the BOJ policy board, especially the governor and to some extent deputy governors, believing that QE would not work. And there was a lot of repeated mention, which many of the politicians as well as media didn't kind of treat kindly, is that Governor Shirakawa has mentioned the limits of aggressive monetary policy when there are other more structural problems associated with the Japanese economy. And also there was a lot of indication from the minutes and interviews where the BOJ and BOJ policy board was more worried about either the moral hazard or market distortion, as well as the difficulty of exit or phase out of QE in the medium to long run. So all these indicated to us not that how these ideas that Gene has outlined has been a crucial component of how the BOJ had taken their policy decisions in the aftermath of a global financial crisis. So obviously, I'm sure your interest is our analysis in Chapter 8, where we talk about the incoming of the Abenomics and the kind of the years after that, from 2012-13 onward. But I will, you know, one thing I will note about this drastic change was the breakdown of monetary policy network. And I will leave that for the Q&A because I'm sure it's a hotly debated topic. So I would like to conclude with the view that policy ideas have mattered quite significantly on the BOJ's monetary policy. And policy board has been protected by this network, as well as the socialization, which created a close kind of a network dynamics within the institution. So I will leave it to the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jean, and sorry for laying out so well what are the key arguments of the book, what are the case studies, and I certainly have noted to ask you later about this breakdown of monetary policy network that led to a very different approach on monetary policy come Abenomics. So now I would like to turn to our two discussants and ask Steve Vogel and Joseph Gannon to offer their impressions and insights from reading the book.
Thank you, Maria. This is really a fabulous book, a tour de force. I'd like to congratulate the authors. I really enjoyed reading it. Let me just start with a comment from my parochial perspective as a scholar of Japanese politics. What the field has really been missing, I would say over the past decade plus, are really good studies of the policy process in Japan. And this fills that gaping hole, and it does so in a brilliant way. And it focuses on, I think, you know, exactly what we should be looking at, which is kind of the nitty-gritty decision-making process within the bureaucracy, or in this case, within the Bank of Japan, the ethos of these agencies, and also kind of the nuanced detail of how they actually do their business. And this book really delivers on that, and I learned a lot from it. It's also methodologically incredibly creative. Sowry described how they do this with some quantitative analysis of the text as well as in-depth case studies. But I guess my role is to challenge and question, so I'll try to do that anyway. The first question I want to raise is the puzzle really all that puzzling? And what I mean by that is that the puzzle they raise is, why is it that Japan wasn't more aggressive with quantitative easing, particularly after the global financial crisis? And the authors, to their credit, note that the situation is not exactly analogous, that Japan was not in exactly the same situation as the U.S. and Europe. But I think they understate that difference. I see three basic differences, again, which they acknowledge. One is that the crisis arrived in Japan later. Second is that Japan had been battling deflation for a long time, so that the situation was new. They say because of that, then all the more reason Japan should have been aggressive, but I think you could make that argument either way. You could also say they've been battling it for a while, so you could see reasons why they actually might be more timid or more cautious because of that. But the biggest difference, I think, is that the global financial crisis wasn't a financial crisis in Japan, right? And the authors very nicely detail how when Japan had its own financial crisis, of course, in the 1990s, at that time they were very acutely aware of the consequences of monetary policy for the financial sector. The same was true of the U.S. and Europe after the global financial crisis, but Japan did not have the same concerns. Another way to make the same point I'm making is that if the global financial crisis had been, this is a counterfactual, but if it had been a financial crisis, I'm guessing they would have been more aggressive and the puzzle would then disappear. Second way to kind of question the question would be, was the Bank of Japan really that timid after all, right? And they focus on this particular moment, and I understand why they do that. But if you look at the overall record, it doesn't seem that timid, right? That Japan was an early starter in the world of aggressive quantitative easing, and they certainly have done quite a bit of experimentation over time. And the differences at this particular moment, I think, can be explained by the things that I was mentioning a bit ago. Also, too much versus too little is obviously easier to say in hindsight than at the time. So one could argue that it wasn't really a matter of the Bank of Japan officials' ideology. It was that they misestimated what too much or what enough was, right? In other words, they may have thought that they were being aggressive, deflation battlers, right? And we can say in hindsight, well, maybe they should have gone a little bit further. But that it may not be so much a matter of ideology, more one of calculation. The authors very nicely point out that, and this relates to that point, which is that they were operating in an environment of high uncertainty, right? In other words, the people, this was a new, relatively new problem, and people didn't know exactly what was going to work. They say because it was that, all the more reason we should focus on ideas. And I guess I would basically agree with that point. I would just argue that, therefore, the slight gradations of, that they were a little bit more timid at a particular moment, right, is less puzzling given that what the objective circumstances were telling them to do was not at all obvious. One way to kind of, I guess, rephrase what the Bank of Japan ideology would be, and I love there's a quote in there about you're playing golf and you're worried about going over the ball, going over the cliff, but there actually is no cliff, right? That's one way to characterize the ideology. In other words, that in a deflationary environment, they're worrying about inflation, which is not something they should really be worrying about. I mean, that's a kind of a a simple way to crystallize. My point is that if we look at it that way, it's not that unusual, right? It's a pretty common view. It comes out in slightly different forms in different countries, but it's not distinctive to the Bank of Japan. I guess the final point on the puzzle, I would say, is that there's a lot of detailed nuance, which I love, in there about all the different things that the Bank of Japan officials are worrying about, right? The gist is that they should have been more aggressive, right? They should have been less worried about inflation, more worried about deflation, and more aggressive. But I think the authors may discount all the kind of other things that they were worrying about, which you list, right? But my point is, like, you know, they were concerned, for example, that many of the economic problems of Japan weren't actually about monetary policy. There were other things going on. So while you recognize that, I guess what I'm saying is that if we wanted to be a little more sympathetic to the poor Bank of Japan officials, we could say, well, actually, maybe some of this were rational things to think about, right? And so it wasn't kind of like that they had ideological blinders. The next thing I wanted to talk about is the relationship between the Ministry of Finance and the Bank of Japan. As you know, Bill Grimes, in his book about Japanese macroeconomic policymaking, basically sees the MOF as the dominant partner in that relationship, right? And obviously, he's looking at the period before the new Bank of Japan law in 1998. But my point is that he argues that there was a kind of a consistent pattern of adjustment that focused more on monetary policy than fiscal policy because the Ministry of Finance was more powerful than the Bank of Japan and was sort of like, you deal with this problem, we don't want to, right? And I guess what my question is, even though you're dealing with the period after the new Bank of Japan law, whether there's kind of a lingering legacy of that relationship. For example, does the fact that the Bank of Japan was not truly independent for so long affect the development of kind of the bureaucratic ethos that you're talking about? I mean, you could argue, right, for example, that the Ministry of Finance would have kind of a stronger, right, bureaucratic ethos because they knew they were the top dog in the Japanese bureaucracy, whereas the Bank of Japan has a history of having to accommodate to, you know, higher authorities now and then. I mean, you could argue it the other way, right, which is that their frustration over decades of subordinates, right, came out with a vengeance when they got their independence. So just my welcome. I'm asking a lot of questions. I'm obviously not expecting you all to answer but throwing them out. Another thing about the bureaucratic ethos, and basically I like that part of the book, but it is a distinctive argument because you're focusing on the policy board, and the policy board is made up of people from inside and from outside. And so if the argument is about internal socialization, right, that only applies to the people who are coming from the inside, right? Now, one of the parts about the book that I love the most is where you talk about how when you get an outside board member, then the Bank of Japan proper people, right, kind of indoctrinate, brainwash, et cetera, right, cultivate those. But I guess my point is that an argument about internal socialization doesn't really apply to those who are coming from the outside, then almost you would have to focus more on how they're influenced. How do you get the people who didn't go through that whole process to buy into this ideology? And maybe we'd have to learn more about kind of the interactions. You do stress, to your credit, that most of the governors during the key periods were from the Bank of Japan, and I recognize that's an important point. Finally, on your model, I'm wondering whether a person's ideology with respect to inflation versus deflation necessarily correlate inversely in the way that you describe in your model. What I mean by that is that I can see very clearly why kind of the standard, quote unquote, hawkish view, right, would be that you have to combat inflation aggressively, And because you're kind of always worried about inflation, you're going to be cautious on combating deflation, right? But at least theoretically, that's kind of one of only four possible boxes, right? To try to make this clear, right? Let's say you think that the deflation needs to be aggressively combated, right? I'm going to try to avoid the word hawkish because it's just going to confuse the point I'm trying to make. But what I'm saying is that if you're aggressive on deflation, doesn't mean you're necessarily not aggressive on inflation, right? So you could have a 4x4 box where you could be aggressive on both, or you could be cautious about both because you don't see that monetary policy is always the right instrument of choice. I'm not saying that those four boxes are equally populated. I would readily agree with you that there's a kind of a hawkish viewpoint that where they do correlate. But even if I'm just a tiny bit right, which is that then it would affect the way that you sort your evidence, right, when you're trying to kind of categorize, right? For example, if you saw somebody making a comment that they were very worried about inflation in the United States, that doesn't necessarily, right, prove that they wouldn't want to combat deflation aggressively in Japan. Just a thought. Final point, and I love it's a very innovative approach, but just one question about the use of those minutes, right, to make the arguments. So the key claim, right, which is really interesting, is that these policy decisions are driven by the ideology and not by, at least not purely by, either political forces or objective economic factors. My question is, are the discussions in the policy board too proximate to the final decision, right, to really capture that, right? In other words, that they're just talking about, they're worried about inflation, and then they are timid about monetary easing. Those other factors that you're excluding may actually be prior to that debate, right? Does that make sense, right? It's a little bit prone to a tautology, right? If the discussion and the decision are so close, right, that discussion may actually have already incorporated the objective economic analysis or the political forces. And so you may not have actually been able to separate that out. That's one thing that just kind of leaves me with a question. Otherwise, a fabulous book, and congratulations.
Thank you so much, Steve. So, Joseph, please.
Oh, thank you. Let me apologize up front that I will have to leave promptly. I had two major events this week. This was this one. And yesterday, there was an IMF conference I was participating in on external imbalances, but because of the funeral of President Bush, that was changed to today. So I actually had to leave that conference to get here, and I have to leave here to get back. My session's going on right now. So I'm going to stay for the panel discussion, but I will leave for the questions, if that's okay. But I apologize. I'm sorry that the funeral was something that happened beyond our control. Like Stephen, I think this is a great book in terms of it's really thorough and convincing, and it's a good read. I mean, it's well written, and also the sort of the organization, it's sort of road mapped quite well, so you can sort of see what's going on, which is nice. You know, it's not a dense book at all in that sense. Yet, even though it's not dense in the sense of being hard to figure out, it is dense in the sense of having detailed documentation of what was really going on in the evolution of the Bank of Japan's thinking in a unique way. So I think if people who care about monetary policy in general, but especially Japanese in particular, this is, like, I think, a unique book. I think the key idea of the book that you read over and over again is this idea of a policy network. The Bank of Japan's policy network, or the policy network of central banking in different countries. policy network, to me it seems a somewhat strange term applied to the Bank of Japan because it was such a small network. You know, that was the problem. It was very insular. You might group the word groupthink comes to mind a lot when I sort of was reading this. And it's not, I mean, it's a problem that all institutions face, and to a greater or lesser extent, you see it at other central banks, and there's a lot of discussion of that, which I thought was very good to compare the central banking things and showing that in other central banks this is also in existence, but there are more avenues for outside voices to be heard in some other central banks than there were in the Bank of Japan, and that's very important. That's a central part of the book. And the Federal Reserve, I used to work at the Federal Reserve. I left at the end of 2009 to come across the street at the Peterson Institute, but I was involved in some of the decisions at the time, which I'll mention. And the book actually sort of the Fed comes out looking well in the book, so I'm happy to say that I don't disagree with that. Although even the Fed had some problems, I think. I mean, all central banks had this experience, you know, that many of the staffers remembered the inflation of the 70s and 80s and the fight against it, and you know, have this feeling that inflation is always lurking around the corner and it's very easy to come back up and be a problem, and getting over that feeling that was, you know, earned in ways that the book describes in Japan, but also in other countries, which the book doesn't go into, but, you know, it's also true in other countries. So central bankers are scarred by that, and getting over that is difficult. My own experience at the Fed the crisis hit us in 2008, 2009. The Fed was very innovative, but I mean, it was forced to. I mean, it would not have done these things if it really hadn't felt the whole bottom was dropping out of the economy. And I actually agree with Chairman Bernanke when he says that the shock that hit the U.S. economy was easily greater than the shock that caused the Great Depression. I believe that's true. It's hard to prove, but I believe that's true in terms of the size and importance of the financial institutions that were hit. And the actions that the Fed took were just a world of difference from what they did in the Great Depression, and I think that made all the difference. But this was a bigger shock, a more immediate and abrupt and sort of change than Japan experienced, in my view, because Japan's crisis, as Steve said, was earlier, and in terms of the deflationary impact of it, it was much slower to see and appreciate. And so I do think the Fed had the benefit of a sharper shock, also the benefit of seeing how Japan sort of sank into deflation sort of almost by accident and not wanting that to happen. But even at the Fed, so I remember when we launched QE1, there was many programs going on. The one I was involved in is now called Quantitative Easing, QE1, and we persuaded David Reichsteiner, and I sort of sat there with Ben Bernanke at the table, chairing the table, and we persuaded them to do a huge program of quantitative easing. And it was sort of my only sleepless night of the crisis when they said yes, because I thought, well, you know, now what have we got ourselves into? If it goes wrong, they'll blame me. But it didn't. But then, you know, after a few months, it became obvious to me that this wasn't going to be enough, that we actually needed to do more. And I started to saying that, but no one wanted to hear that. So that's when I left the Fed and came here to Peterson Institute. But it just shows that it's hard. I mean, there was just innovation fatigue, or sort of, you know, the Fed felt like, oh, we've just done so much and the worst is over. We can't possibly consider ever doing this again. Of course, they did end up doing it again with QE2 and then Operation Twist and then QE3. So they got around to it. But it's tough anywhere to sort of combat these instincts outside of a crisis. So, that's sort of my experience of this. The public, one thing that the book mentions, which I think is also worthy of mention, is the Abe campaign on getting back to inflation. It's truly extraordinary if you look around the world. I mean, you know, we had the opposite thing in America, where the political pressure on the Fed after QE during QE was sort of against it. There was very low support for it, and the Fed did it anyway. But in Japan, there was a whole political campaign for the prime minister whose main issue, as I recall, I think it was the main issue, was to have more inflation. I mean, it's just amazing. So it's a truly – and I guess it sort of highlights that the insularity of the Bank of Japan in not seeing this ended up forcing the political system to take action. So the book really tells you the inside story of all that. I think it's great. A couple of things that the book talks about that accurately describe sort of the internal Japanese views, but in which I have a personally different view or somehow would add to it a bit, is the two things. One is on the first round of quantitative easing in Japan from 2001 to 2006. And here I actually disagree a little bit with Steve Vogel, because I actually think that wasn't a big deal, and especially in hindsight. The book says that, in fact, when they did this, the average maturity of Bank of Japan holdings of JGBs fell. And that's one reason why it didn't do much. But also, and the book talks about other reasons, it wasn't seen as permanent and things. I think the book, what it says is accurate. But I think I would say that I would stress that in that first QE round in Japan in the early 2000s, what I learned later, I didn't know at the time when I was covering Japan, but I learned later, is that the Bank of Japan only bought 10-year JGBs that had 1 year or so left to maturity. And that makes all the difference. I mean, that's like just buying T-bills. I mean, and it didn't expose the Bank of Japan to any risk. It didn't remove the duration out in the bond market. And when Kuroda came in and did QE, that did the opposite. It actually increased the average maturity of the Bank of Japan's portfolio and bought really long-term JGBs. And that exposed the Bank of Japan to a lot of risk, but it also reduced a lot of the duration of the market. That had huge, and you could see it in bond yields. I mean, the second round had a massive impact on bond yields. To this day, the 10-year bond yield in Japan is zero. Unheard of. I didn't believe that could be possible. And it's just a different animal from the first round of QE, in my view. I remember, in fact, just another anecdote. The Bank of Japan had a conference in late 2010 when Shirakawa was governor, and they wanted to learn about what we were doing in America and QE. And I had written a paper with some co-authors, and we were invited to present it. And when we told the staffers of the Bank of Japan, and Shirakawa was sitting in the audience, what we were doing, that we were buying, you know, 10-year bonds and 30-year mortgage-backed securities and taking all this massive risk onto our balance sheet, everybody in the room was just couldn't believe it. And they said the Bank of Japan could never do that. We were told it could never happen in Japan. They would never do it. Too risky. Wouldn't happen. But Kuroda did it. So I just to highlight the real, it's a huge shift in Japan that this happened. The other thing that I think the book gets right in terms of Japanese views, but I have a slightly different view, is the whole Plaza Louvre and this view at the Bank of Japan and other places in China, in Japan, that the U.S. Forced Japan to have excessively easy monetary policy in the 80s, and that made the bubble, caused the bubble and made the bubble worse and caused all the problems later, and blame it all on U.S. pressure for easy monetary policy in Japan. I don't accept that at all. I think that is completely wrong. I mean, that what you say in the book about how people say that is right, you know, you describe those views. But if you, I've written papers on this. If you look at the history, what the U.S. wanted was a stronger yen and a lower Japanese trade surplus and regulatory changes that would make it easier to export to Japan. And monetary policy, we actually didn't have a strong feeling about. We acquiesced. If what was going on was that inside Japan, there was tremendous and concern about the strength of the yen. I mean, the businesses were screaming, and they wanted action taken to keep the yen from rising anymore. And it was entirely internally generated in Japan. And so there are two options. They could either have easy monetary policy, or you could do massive foreign exchange intervention. And the U.S. preferred easier monetary policy. So, yes, we would prefer that, because easy monetary policy at least stimulates spending in Japan and doesn't make the trade sustain a trade surplus. So in that sense, yeah, we prefer that over the alternative. But it wasn't that it was high on our list to have easy monetary policy in Japan. So I think that I think that's just trying to blame the U.S. for something that was entirely a Japanese mistake and problem. They paid too much attention. Too much attention was paid to the yen at the time and not enough to the overheating economy. Even though the yen was strong and people didn't like it, the economy was overheating. And the Bank of Japan didn't see that. So that was, I wouldn't blame it on the U.S. But my final point is that the book is very much focused on the process of ideas about monetary policy in Japan and how change came in the end and how we have a new policy. It's different. But it is somewhat noncommittal about whether this new policy is the right policy or working. I mean, it sort of hints that maybe it is, but it doesn't really a cheerleader for Abenomics. I think the readers want to know. I mean, what was this a change in the right direction or not, or did it matter? I'm just an unabashed supporter of Kuroda and Abe, and I think that what they're doing is right. It's unfortunate that they claimed too much for what it could do too soon, and even I'm a little surprised at how long it's taken inflation to rise, but it is slowly rising. Unemployment is now at a 25-year low. I just put out a blog post with colleague Takeshi Toshiro, who is sitting here. We just put a blog post out yesterday at a Peterson website sort of explaining all this. It is working. It is working slower than you might have thought. But what it says to me is that the potential output in Japan was higher than people thought, that the natural rate of unemployment was lower than people thought. We used to think the natural rate of unemployment in Japan was 2.5%, but for a long time it was around 4 or 5%, and we began to think, well, maybe that was the natural rate. Well, that was wrong. It was always 2.5. We've now come back to 2.5 after 25 years of being above 2.5. That's a tremendous achievement, but only now would you even expect to see any inflationary pressure, because you need to put your economy above potential to get inflationary pressure. I mean, I guess one thing, maybe some people thought that just saying you'd get inflation would create inflation, but I don't believe in that. I think you have to do things to create inflation. You have to overstimulate the economy. And that's a good thing for Japan to actually be above potential for a while for a change and actually have a lot of job creation and put pressure on prices. And it's slowly happening. I mean, the only worry is that to get there, the JGB yield, the 10-year JGB yield, is now zero, which at this point, buying more JGBs, in my view, doesn't do much because there's really no way you can push it below zero. So maybe the Bank of Japan should be buying more equities, more ETFs in real estate, or maybe we need some more fiscal monetary coordination for a while. I don't know. But even if we don't get that, if we don't get a bad shock, I think we will slowly get back to 2% inflation. I think it's on track. It should continue until you reach the objective. It's very important to, in my view, to achieve. If the central bank says it wants 2% inflation, then it's important that it does what it needs to get there. I think it is working slower than anyone would have liked, but it is working, and it's actually achieving remarkable results in Japan, where they're no longer in deflation. The core headline inflation is 1.5, but that's not going to last because it's mostly oil prices. Core inflation is rising slowly. It's 0.5%, and I think it'll take another couple, 2-3 years to get to 2, but I think it will.
Terrific, really. Wonderful comments. So much on the table. I want to give the opportunity first to the authors of the book to respond. At least three issues jumped at me I would like to emphasize, but obviously there are many others that you want to pursue. I think a fundamental question is there a puzzle to explain or not? Second, was the Bank of Japan really acting with ideological blinders, or it was just a case of miscalculation and how much or how far to go? And third, I'm very glad that Joseph also brought the discussion to the current situation, and I would like to get a statement from the authors as to what is your evaluation of this activism in monetary policy, where we are today in the policy to try to bring inflation to 2%, and we are even now discussing risks of this strategy and exit. Maybe it's too premature, but again, what is your assessment of what has happened since policy shifted gears so dramatically. So, and any other questions, of course, there was so much raised that was very important that you would like to discuss.
So, thank you very much for a wonderful comment, and I really appreciate learning from you, too. Maybe we can do a sequel on this book. So I think I would like to address the second question of the ideology and how is this kind of question of policy ideas. I think we'd like to still insist that the policy ideas mattered quite a bit, and there is a certain kind of a clear direction that policy ideas are biased towards, bias probably sounds a bit loaded, but still it has a certain tendency. But at the same time, I would like to note, former Governor Shirakawa just published a book, which is like this thick, so I haven't read it yet. But the commentary of this it's from the newspaper is that he also again emphasized the uncertainty that economists are working with, and especially on the monetary policy, which is very hard to really get the kind of concrete grasp of what's going on in many parts of the whole picture. So, by even taking that uncertainty, and I think that's where we are starting from, even though there's a lot of debate, and those who are engaged in debate, like, Joe has just done, it has a really strong position one way or the other. But I think fundamental uncertainty is quite prevalent in this. And when this environment of uncertainty, policy ideas really guide the policies of certain institutions, and I would like to kind of insist on that part. So I will take that, and then maybe you too, Jean.
So on the question about the nature of the puzzle and sort of how puzzling is it, I think that both of the discussants really kind of agreed that the GFC did kind of push the hand of the Bank of England as well as also the Federal Reserve, and I think that that's really indisputable, so I acknowledge that point. But I think that even if we strip away those comparisons and we just look at the Bank of Japan, there's still a puzzle there, because Japan was the only industrialized democracy to go through such a long period of deflation. And so regardless, I mean, obviously, I think a crisis lowers probably the political bar to action and can jumpstart more radical maneuvers. But still, I think that doesn't negate the fact that the Bank of Japan had many critiques of its policy, had been going on and suffering from deflation for a very long time with arguably very high social and economic costs. And there was political pressure as well. So I think even without that comparison, there is a puzzle. On the assessment issue, that's an interesting point. We talking about uncertainty, we had this conversation many times among ourselves. We started probably around 2013 thinking about this project and writing, and it was really unclear what was going to happen. There's some disagreement amongst us about how much to emphasize that, partly because of a future Japanese audience, and this issue is so polarizing, so we didn't want it to be seen purely from the lens of as pro or against. I've presented this parts of this project in Germany and Sweden and the U.S. and also in Japan, and when we do this in Japan, the nature of the response is completely different, I think, which also reflects that, Japan and many people within Japan and economists within Japan see the world differently, and it always kind of quickly reverts to, are you pro Abenomics? Are you pro Kuroda? And we get a lot of critiques about QE, and that really isn't the central sort of kind of thrust of our argument. Personally, also, there was some disagreement amongst us. I tended to be a little more positive in taking a kind of normative stance in terms of the assessments, but we had other considerations to make. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. And so as for the third point of assessment, as just Jean told, that we had a lots of discussions, but we couldn't figure out which what kind of how to say assessment we should do, and so. But Saori mentioned just Shirakawa, ex-governor Shirakawa published a book, and he said that. Okay. I should start. Okay. As for the monetary policy as a tool, I think the monetary policy used to be a kind of a neutral to insulate from political discussions. But the crisis happened, and then the monetary policy became a kind of, how to say, in the middle of political discussions. So that is, I mean, that the monetary policy is nowadays politicized a lot. So it's a kind of very difficult part. So that is, I think, maybe related to the lots of crises happen now. So that's a problem of monetary policy in the terms of political sense.
Thank you very much. I find it really interesting how much you have shared that when it comes to the assessment of unconventional monetary policy, when you present in different countries, the reaction is very different, but also that the authors have very different views, and I commend your collegiality in managing to get to the book a finished product when there is this debate amongst yourselves and how politicized the conversation seems to be in Japan about the policy. I'm sure that the audience may have other questions about these and the other elements. So now we're going to bring in all of you to the discussion. There's a mic going around, so if you can just raise your hand. And when you get the mic, if you can identify yourselves and then ask the question. So here, Tobias.
Thank you.
And thank you to Joseph Gannon. He has to leave. Thank you.
Hi, Tobias Harris from Teneo. Gene, congratulations. I've really been looking forward to this ever since you told me you were working on it. So it's really exciting to hear. I have more questions than I can probably ask. So I'm going to focus on one because it does seem that, and I don't, maybe you get into this in the book, but it was sort of touched on, but maybe it could have been explored a little more. But I mean, to what extent was the BOJ sort of a battleground in of a transnational battle of ideas about monetary policy, right? You talk about the Bundesbank, you talk about the Bank of International Settlement. You look at the kind of, the reflationist school that brought these ideas, right? So you had this kind of political outgroup that suddenly found themselves on the inside after 2012. But they were taking ideas from Bernanke and Krugman, and so you had, the development of unconventional monetary policy ideas during the 2000s, sort of moving into the center elsewhere, and then sort of finally you're being imported in Japan. And so you had this, to what extent do you talk about these dynamics that, Japan isn't, it is part of this transnational network of ideas about monetary policy and central banks. And that battle was fought for a long time. Then finally, they won their big victory in 2012. But, you did have this process. So I don't know how, if you can talk about that and how that played out.
Great question. We do look at that at the book because, as you mentioned, there was a battleground. There were people that were outside of the network that really disagreed with the Bank of Japan's policy within Japan as well, including Hamada Koichi, formerly of Yale University, who was also a close advisor to Abe in forming his brain trust to pursue his reflationary policy. There were also people like Takatoshi Ito at Columbia University as well that really disagreed as well. And another person that kind of features pretty frequently in our book was a former BOJ policy member, Nakahara Nobuyuki. And he was someone who didn't buy the BOJ kind of worldview. And this was, in around like 2000, 2001. And he introduced the first proposals for QE, which were rejected. He basically introduced them, every single policy meeting, and they were rejected by everyone except for him. And he was someone who was, going out and talking to economists from around the world and, getting them on the phone and discussing policy ideas with them. So he's kind of the exception that proves the rule to some extent. And, part of what we really focus on is the dynamics of who gets nominated. And so who gets nominated was heavily influenced by the BOJ and also the Ministry of Finance, who at least had fought over many issues, but at least when it came to unconventional monetary policy, saw eye to eye. Nakahara was appointed because he happened to be a personal friend of Fukui. And so that he's the one guy that kind of got in through that personal connection that really kind of went against the grain of the BOJ's ideology. But I think the larger debate, though, is extremely important, and we do touch on that. Great question. Thank you.
Yes, hi. Matthew Kennedy. I'm a recent graduate from SOAS at the University of London. My main question is, were there any lessons from the 1990s financial crisis that the BOJ did or didn't employ that could have eased Japan's deflationary climate? That's it.
Is the you're talking about the asset bubble bursting in the early 1990s or the late 1990s? So no, obviously that was part of the first round of BOJ's actions. Obviously that's the time, exactly the time deflation started, as well as the BOJ's de jure independence came about. And resolving that financial crisis was one of the key feature of BOJ, at least, you know, kind of accepting to do the zero interest rate policy, as well as kind of first QE. So it was crucial. I mean, BOJ was very aware of how financial sector is so crucial in getting Japanese economy back on track. So this was documented in the case study chapter, where how that was a major theme, and the timing and so on were coordinated with the government in order to help the financial sector recover, and implementation of that whole reconstruction plan to be successful. Do you want to say something? Okay.
Thank you. Glenn Wesley from Inter-American Development Bank, but now retired, and World Bank. But my question kind of stretches you guys a little bit into other places. So one is, I wondered if you could comment on the debt overhang that Japan now has, how it might deal with this. And secondly, after 20 years of deflation, why is QE finally implemented? Why wasn't it thought of and done a lot sooner? And I wonder if the role of the education system, perhaps not fostering enough creativity, might have played a role.
Thank you. Thanks to Barbara. I'm Barbara Stallings from Brown University and Tsinghua University in Beijing. First to the question of, is there a puzzle? I also am a little unclear as to whether there is a puzzle. Gene Park talked about long-term deflation having high socioeconomic costs. It seems to me this is a classic example of the frog in the pot of hot water. And it gets turned up, 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 and they don't notice that they're boiling and are about to die, right? One certainly read in the newspapers, and my friends in Japan would echo this, we're a high-income country. One of my friends said, they want us to buy all this additional stuff. But he said, if I bought a larger television, I would have to get a new apartment because it won't fit in the front door. So no one, it seemed to me, at least that I knew, thought that this was such a big problem. The economists certainly thought it was a problem, or at least some of them did. Your policy board didn't seem to, but some certainly did. And then I also wanted to just underline the idea of the lack of a financial crisis. I did some work on other Asian countries, also in comparison to some Latin American countries, and the lack of a financial crisis in 2008, 2009, compared in the Asian case to the late 90s, was incredibly important. Economic problems, but that is not at all the same as a financial crisis, which demands much more instantaneous or short-term kinds of remedies than economic crisis, which is, again, longer term, and one can think one can deal with it in time.
Thank you. Comments from the panelists?
So if I may I? So if I may address to Barbara's question about this boiling frog in a, well, no, not boiling, well, frog boiling, well, you know, gradually boiling in water. You know, I think it's kind of interesting. I think it's still puzzling in the sense that, yes, I understand. You know, I go back to Japan quite often. People are very happy with where they are, safest country in the world, and this and that. But So then, yes, I understand that politicians would not reflect on that. They don't care because that's not the kind of things that has any electoral consequences. At the same time, I think economists and those who are at the Bank of Japan and Ministry of Finance has to be much, much more worried. But the dynamics was reverse, right? Abe and all the politicians kind of heightened on this deflation to be the enemy number one, and the BOJ and Ministry of Finance kind of thinking, well, not too fast, kind of thing. So even if you spin it in that way, that deflation is not felt by people, I think it's still a very kind of puzzling political question. Maybe so, yes. But that doesn't, again, why did experts who should know this long-term consequence and who are in the guardian state of really having to tackle this didn't do it as aggressively as they could have? So in that sense, I think it's the puzzling thing. Yeah, sorry.
I'm going to add to that really quickly. Actually, Saudi and I one of our graduate students are working on a project looking at whether legislators are responsive to deflation. It's a sort of quantitative analysis, and we find that they're not, but they are very sensitive to inflation. So your basic point is right. And in fact, the BOJ keeps survey data, and it shows through most of the 2000s up to now, really, that people like deflation, either like it or feel neutral. But again, I think the role of central bankers is very different. And ultimately, why did Abe act? He probably acted because he saw that there was probably foregone economic output, right? Japan had been the so-called sick person of the industrialized world. It was a political opening, and he was right, and it's paid off handsomely. I would argue potentially that the degree of cabinet instability was due to Japan's long deflation and sort of economic stagnation. So I think there was a sort of political logic for him to do so. On the question about the debt overhang, that certainly plays very heavily into the discourse about QE potentially being dangerous, right? And one of the sort of concerns is that, okay, if the Bank of Japan's financing this highly indebted government that has moderately high deficits, that makes it easier for them to run up debt because there's less external market constraint on them being fiscally irresponsible. As we discuss in our book, there's a good case to be made that deflation made their debt overhang a lot worse because it's really bad for revenue. Inflation generally is good from a revenue perspective, and Ben Bernanke here at Brookings Institution have done sort of back-of-the-envelope calculations and suggested that the debt-to-GDP ratio would be significantly lower if they had higher inflation, and other people have made similar analyses as well. Also, Joe Gagnon in a piece argued that Japan, essentially, because it has a larger debt, needs to have larger interventions in through quantitative easing in order to get the same effect that a country that had less debt would get. So that would be actually a case for bigger and bolder quantitative easing, potentially. And on the education system, one peculiar thing, I don't know if I would go that far, and we didn't investigate that angle, but almost every recruit to the Bank of Japan is hired with an undergraduate degree, in usually in economics. So they're not coming in with master's degrees or PhDs. And sometimes they get sent abroad and get a master's degree. In rare cases, they get PhDs. There aren't many PhDs within the institution, and those that are there tend to be kind of cloistered together in the research wing, which does not have that much influence of the monetary policy making, generally speaking. So maybe it's not about the education system, but again, how they're plucking these people out as undergrads and sort of socializing them. That was more sort of central to our argument, at least.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Eva de Francisco, Board of Governors, following the Japanese economy. That was a very interesting discussion and a summary of the book. I'm trying to think about the future and how the Bank of Japan is behaving now, whether they're still acting kind of in group thinking. Maybe now they went all the way. Now they want to be like the rest of the developed economies. They keep on having the 2% inflation target. Maybe some people are calling to reduce it and call it a victory instead of just pushing expansionary monetary policy for longer. some people think they're being successful and inflation is increasing very slowly, but other people that, you know, monetary policy has a limited ability to affect the economy, and they're never going to get to 2%. They're losing credibility. Why not just reduce the inflation target to 1% and be different? Right now it's group thinking. We want to be like every other developed country and keep the 2%. Why not just change it? Maybe we, you know, we are different in other ways. Let's reduce inflation to 1% and move on. Are they worried about the size of the quantitative easing, the assets in the balance sheet of the Bank of Japan? Very big. How are they going to get out of it? Like, how would you think or have things change for the future? That would be my question. Thank you.
Michael Macedic, PBS Online News Hour, also pitching forward a little bit. I've seen some articles in the Western press, I think primarily the Financial Times, expressing concern that there may be a desire to tap on the brakes, both in monetary and fiscal policy. But things are so delicately balanced that if you tap too hard, you could push the country back into recession the way that consumer tax did a few years ago.
I think as for the question of group thinking, I think you mean the policy board decision? As far as the BOJ policy board is concerned, I think Prime Minister Abe hired almost similar ideas people into the policy board. So, and I think policy board is supposed to be a diverse opinion, in my opinion. And so then they created some decision. But in terms of nowadays, that the policy board is kind of a similar person in the board. So that means maybe this kind of group thinking, right? It's very difficult for the people to raise a different idea from that kind of situation. So,
yeah, I want to sort of emphasize that point. I mean, it's pretty remarkable. I don't know if this has happened in many other countries, but Abe's been in power long enough to have replaced every single person on the Monetary Policy Board. And so I was just looking at some of the votes last night, and the dissenter, there's been one guy who's a dissenter who's a recent appointment, the deputy governor, Wakatabe, and he's actually pushing in a more anti-deflationary direction. He really wants to stimulate more inflation. So if there's any kind of dissent, it's in that direction. So there is, I think, everything does reflect Abe. But what's happened and what's fundamentally different is that monetary policy is fully now in the political debate. So opposition parties are saying, okay, well, we should have a 1% target rather than a 2% target. So it's become a complete political football. So the network will never be as closed as it was. The BOJ has lost control over it. And so that game's over.
Okay, so this kind of reveals our political debate here with especially Jean and me. But, you know, I think there are a lot of concerns in, you know, going forward. And I just read in Nikkei newspaper that IMIS is the think tank of the Bank of Japan. And there are some very prevalent, well-known report coming out of negative impact of QQE as well as a negative interest rate. And they actually, so Bank of Japan is the bigger entity, and then policy board are the kind of half external and half internal entity that makes the policy decision, monetary policy decision. But this research think tank kind of signals things that BOJ proper, the big institution, kind of is thinking about. out, and sometimes they kind of signal that. And the fact that this came in English, her name is Junko Koeda, I think, is the author, and that came in English, that's criticizing QQE and negative interest rate just like a month ago, really signals some of the concerns. And especially, again, looking at Japanese newspaper, maybe that's the source of information that makes our view somewhat different. But Japanese newspapers are talking about the fact that, well, now that this, you know, trade war is going on, China's slow growth is, you know, impending, you know, U.S. might be facing a recession going forward in the next year or two. You know, the Bank of Japan doesn't have any instrument beyond what it has done so far to really get back at that kind of, address that kind of a slowdown. You know, yes, it's true that I agree with Joe Gagnon that now the Japanese economy is doing quite well in a relative sense, but now when the crisis hit, what does Bank of Japan have in their own arsenal that it's been all used up. So, you know, obviously, you know, buying more stock is probably the only one that's been, you know, discussed as a possibility. But then, you know, then all Japanese stocks will be purchased by the Bank of Japan, and that's not going to be good for the economy overall.
So you guys have an interesting debate going on. Let me bring Ben, and if there's another question, we can take two at a time. We'll start with Ben.
Thank you, Maria. I'm Ben Self, the Mansfield Foundation. I want to congratulate you. It's a wonderful accomplishment, and I really enjoyed your presentation about the book. Former life, I was a constructivist. I was looking at Japanese security policy through the lens of ideas. And I'm surprised not to hear the word constructivist, but I'm glad that approach has reached the study of the ministry and especially the Bank of Japan. But one of the challenges, analytical challenges, is that ideas, aside from being amorphous, are often intervening variables rather than independent variables. And they're often the result of interests. So where you stand depends on where you sit, means that most of these policy positions on different issues can be traced back to an interest, whether it's asset holders' interests in assuring that, you know, maintenance of the value of their assets, or national security actors' interests in larger defense budgets, or so on. So I just wanted to tie that into Steve Vogel's very important point about the proximity of the meeting and the decision, and both of those being shaped by interests feeding in well beforehand. That how do you rule out the influence of powerful interest groups shaping the way these policymakers think? It is an intervening variable. You can definitely define it as having an influence, but is it an original variable, or is it really just a step in the policy process that fundamentally derives from interest groups? Thank you.
Thanks. Bill Ellis at George Mason University. Low interest rates are generally harmful to retirement fund funding, and also to retirees who are trying to live off savings. You mentioned negative interest rates. So I don't hear much about that here. Maybe it is spoken about here. But what about in Japan? Is that a big part of the discussion, how low interest rates are harming retirement security?
I'll take the first question. Saudi will take the second question. I think these are great theoretical questions, right? So do ideas reflect interests, right? Someone could pretend to use a rhetoric and not be sincere about it, right, and be motivated by some material interest, hypothetically.
Be sincere,
right.
Have a reason to sincerely.
Right. So, I mean, one thing that we talk about in our theoretical setup is that there is an interest-based model of monetary policy, but it focuses largely on the interests of politicians and their electoral incentives, right? They want to get elected, they want to juice the economy, they put pressure on central bankers, and that's the basic model. What's completely missing, of course, is what central bankers think and how they see the world and whether they're going to be responsive, what their preferences are towards inflation or deflation. And that is completely missing from all the models of political economy, and that's where we kind of see our work kind of fitting in. Now, there has been one person, Christopher Adolph at University of Washington, who's tried to argue that central bankers themselves have certain material interests, right? They think about getting some cushy job in the financial sector afterwards, right? And he has this complex and sophisticated, very sophisticated model. It really doesn't apply to Japan, though. We went through and looked at all the governors and the deputy governors. Not one single one has followed that trajectory into some kind of lucrative financial position. By the time they retired, they're at the end of their career. Like, you know, Kuroda's in his mid-70s at this point. Shirakawa was the youngest. I think he was just before 70 when he retired. And again, we looked at their academics and think tanks. We went and looked at actually their paths. And so that model doesn't fit. So there are potentially other interests that may matter, but these are organizational interests, right? And so those organizational interests and the ideas are, I would grant you, very difficult to separate out. But I think that these, you know, organizational interests and these ideas have this very, very tight relationship. One is, you know, not to get entangled too much politically by taking on risk, which then may sort of come back and hurt the Bank of Japan, its independence and things like that. So there are these interests, but they're not, you know, classical material interests.
And also, I think the Japanese monetary policy, I think idea matters. But I don't know whether in other issue area and in other countries. I think monetary policy is very, very good for the example of idea matters. Yeah.
So let me address this retirement, and Japan is obviously very kind of aging society, and all that is very crucial. So at the beginning, early stage of the new BOJ after 1998, there was one of the policy board member, Professor Shinotsuka, right, who was an economist and who opposed any kind of easing because of that. Pensioners and how the people's living standard will be jeopardized because of fixed income people jeopardized because of that. But she was always kind of an outlier along with Nakahara that voted on the other, totally the other direction. So that was relevant then. These days, though, now all the pension fund, well, not all the pension, a significant component of pension funds are now invested in stock market. That's the kind of way in which Japan has kind of shifted that model. So Abenomics in some ways is so far working fine for the pensioners because the pension fund has been sustained by the growing stock market, stock market going up, while the danger is, well, I don't know, that kind of obviously exposes it to the uncertainty. I think just having said that, all this kind of mechanisms, but, you know, I think, you know, Japanese population are now used to not having any major return on the savings or investment, you know, 0.15 is the norm. And so that hasn't been a major uproar as long as the government can manage to pay the Social Security and stuff, which, again, is getting to be precarious because of the sustainability of that long term, too.
Wonderful. I want to congratulate the authors for this really tremendous volume, this book. I want to borrow Steve's term. It's a tour de force, and I think that they have shown that in their conversation today. Before you leave, you have an opportunity to get your own copy of the book. There's a table at the back of the room, and please join me in congratulating them for their publication.